This is part two of a speech by Kathy McMahon, the American psychologist who specializes in peak oil blues. Peak oil is when the world reaches its highest production point and then heads into a decline while reaching into the most polluting sources, like the tar sands. Many of us have difficulties coping once we realize the world will run out of oil, practically the lifeblood of our civilization. Kathy runs a blog, peakoilblues.com, where you can learn from others and share your experiences. We return to Kathy McMahon, recorded in Vancouver by Radio EcoShock on October 18, 2010.
So I define Panglossian disorder as the neurotic tendency towards extreme optimism in the face of likely cultural and planetary collapse. And the interesting thing is, it's not just people who reject all this stuff that suffer from Panglossian disorders. I had a lunch today with somebody who also was suffering, and he's a major activist in the field. Because Panglossian disorder is partly a result of living in the matrix, because it's so hard to live in the matrix every single day and know what's coming, and yet have no indication that the reality that you know is coming is actually evident anywhere. Here's one of my readers defined as Panglossian. Just because it sucks so much doesn't mean it isn't going to happen. And, of course, this is a truism we all live by, which is reality is what doesn't go away just because you stop believing in it. So whether you believe in peak oil or whether you believe in climate change or not, that doesn't matter. If you're standing on the railroad tracks and I say to you, you know, that's not safe because a train comes through here in about 3 minutes, and you go, I don't believe a train goes through here, that when you see the train coming, you as an individual have a choice. Are you going to stay here with this dimwit or are you going to get off the tracks? And, you know, there's a whole article about thinning the herd, you know, some quality of if they're staying on the tracks, if they say, no, that's not a train, because a train doesn't come through here, it's going to impact them. And it's going to impact them dramatically. Now, why this is important is that human beings have an odd phenomenon. Their phenomenon is, and we've discovered this with wilderness survival, Gonzalez writes about this. He says when people go and get lost, let's say in the woods during winter time, they will look at their compass, and their compass says north is this way. But they believe they're going south. So instead of trusting the compass, they trust their cognitive map, and they smash the compass. And there's records of people doing this. Or they'll look at a pond, and they'll look at their map, and the map doesn't have a pond on it, and they say, well, that pond must have formed last winter or something. So they trust their cognitive map, and it's one of the reasons why children under the age of 6 often survive in wilderness when they're lost more than older children, because they just rely on their senses. They don't rely on their cognitive map because developmentally they don't have one yet. Whereas older children will say, right over that hill, my parents are waiting for me. So they'll exhaust themselves or freeze themselves because they believe they'll be rescued. Of course, another thing that we see commonly is people don't turn around and backtrack. When they get lost, they just keep going. The reason that this is really important for the peak oil community and for those of us who believe in the three big E's, as Chris Martinson says, is because we have our own cognitive maps. And we expect reality is going to conform to those cognitive maps. But our future is so uncertain and so volatile that if we keep a love relationship with that cognitive map, we are not going to be able to adapt very quickly when circumstances don't turn out like we imagine that they should, because that's the way we thought they would. Obviously, we are facing a culture that is like the three monkeys, and you can tell from this slide that it's an old slide. Because We used to say that was before Obama got into office, and we don't say that anymore. We were expecting a solution to a dilemma, and we didn't get it. Okay, paternalistic features are interesting. You'll have people who are the most anti-establishment, who hate the government, who do not trust the corporations. And what will they say when you talk to them about the three biggies? They say, they are going to fix it. Or it's a scam by them, and it's not really true, and they won't look into it. You also have the sort of passive, aggressive kind of style, which is, you know, you're probably right, you know, just thank you for calling, and, you know, that's it. I discovered the NASCARian features because I was asked by Honda to write a post, because Honda has realized that oil is a finite substance, and while they suffer from the Panglossian of thinking it's going to be way far in the future and they have 80 years to figure it out, they asked me to write, and they connected their Honda Facebook page to my page. When I went to see the comments from the gearheads that are on the Honda site, there was no sign of intelligent life except for this one woman who wrote and said, I think I'm going to have to reconsider my future. Other than that, there was all just Panglossian, totally. The neoliberal economomaniac tendencies basically say, as if you throw money at something, it magically appears. So it confuses energy with economics. And so they feel that you just keep throwing money and then oil will reappear, or it'll show up where it wasn't before. Well, this is the problem with the U.S. in throwing money at anything, really, or even Honda Motors, because Honda Motors needs money for research and development. And if they're not selling their cars, and the new cars are dramatically going down in terms of new car sales, how are they going to put the money into all that technological innovation that they're hoping for? A few others, purely magical thinking. You know, we see that a lot among learned people. And I'm always shocked how these people ever got through MIT and are able to do what I'll show you in just a minute. MacGyverism, for those of you who don't know it, it was a TV show during the 70s, and he could basically fix his way out of anything. If he had chewing gum and a screwdriver, he could create a nuclear bomb. I mean, that was pretty much what it. And so you'll hear people say, you know, pig dung is going to be the next fossil fuel, or Coke cans can be turned into solar panels, so we don't have to worry because we have lots of Coke cans. They all follow the same formula, and this is the formula. First we'll do A, and then we'll do B, and then we'll do C, and then a miracle happens, and then we'll do D and E. Do you notice that? There's a hand wave motion that goes along with it. They'll say, well, what we'll do is we're going to do A, B, and C. Oh, yeah, but we'll deal with that. And then we'll do C, D, and E. So the hand wave is basically the Tinkerbell method. The hand wave basically says, then there'll be fairy dust, and it'll fix the problem. And they do it with dramatic problems. You know, like they'll say, we'll just take water, and we'll just stuff water down, and we'll frack it. And for those of you who've seen that show, Battlestar Galactica, frack is not a compliment, you know? And that's what they're doing all over. They decide they're going to frack us. And they are really fracking us something bad. I'm telling you right now, we are being fracked like nobody's business. And, of course, if you know anything about fracking, what happens is you put the water and a bunch of chemicals down there, and before you know it, you turn on your water fountain, you get flames coming out of it, you know, the hand wave. Then we'll resolve that. It's a little problem. You've got the religiosity. Now, of course, you have, you know, my Savior is going to rescue us. You know, you do have the delusional types that say, bring it on, I want the Armageddon, because then we're going to all float up to heaven. But you also have the New Age delusion, which is sort of goes like, Gaia loves us. And we have to trust that Gaia is going to save us. And this passes for logical discourse. Now, there's the other side, okay? I talk about the positive sort of spin on it, but there's also the negative spin on it. And there's the sort of emergency, this is going to happen tomorrow, and, well, this is a good cartoon to explain it. For those who are listening, it's the company economist, and he's saying, in 2010, the economy will collapse, and the world will plunge into darkness, and the next one, and you will all be eaten by cannibals who will in turn die from the diseases of your that riddle your body. And his boss says, please never talk again. And he goes, yeah, I get that a lot lately. So you have people who are painting dramatically horrible pictures. And they have various genres and subcategories too. The Darwinian I'm particularly fond of, that says basically that destruction is in our genes. We can't help but be violent. And yet, you know, the interesting thing about the Darwinian is that extramarital affairs, you can't get away with saying the Darwinian excuse. You know, you can't say to your husband or wife, well, honey, the reason I had that sex was because it's in our genes to be promiscuous. Because your spouse is going to say, well, you know, if you kept it in your genes, we wouldn't be having the marital problems we're having right now. So that really doesn't work, but it seems to appeal to people who only want to look at one part of human nature. They don't want to look at the part of human nature that says that we're social mammals, that we have a ton of social emotions that allow us to be able to get along with one another. They only want to look at the negative end of it, and that's what makes it a Panglossian disorder. It's a belief that modern Homo sapiens are unsustainable by their nature, and that it's an subconscious genetic predisposition. Survivalistic features. You know, we talk a lot about survivors being the guys with the guns and the beans in the hills. Rob Hopkins and I have a personally antagonistic relationship around this one particular point. But we don't talk about the middle class or upper middle class who basically say, I'm just going to outfit my home, retrofit it, and then I'll be pretty safe, you know, because I got mine. The true survivalist, and I know quite a few of them, the true survivalist does not believe that they can make it alone. They recognize that the ability to form communities, tight-knit communities, are essential for survival on any level. So the survivalistic feature is sort of a fake survivalistic position. We think when we're suffering from this Panglossian disorder, that the future is going to look like this. You're going to have the golden hordes. They're going to be coming and you know, tearing up your stuff and stealing it and all that kind of thing. And what I would argue is that the golden hordes are those teenagers that are a pain in the neck that haven't been working for the last 5 summers, and you never went out of your way to make sure they had a steady income. They are the ones you need to be worried about. That guy who just seems to wander around the neighborhood and really look lost and disturbed, and he is the one you have to worry about. So part of the issue is we have to accept responsibility for the fact that people in our neighborhoods are either going to be our survival or they're going to be the problem. Zombie doom is really denial. It talks about the other side of denial. We don't talk about this, and this is denial. You have gated communities in? Not a lot. Not like the U.S. We're big into them, because we think all you need is you hire a rent-a-cop for minimum wage, you put a cheap pistol in his back pocket, and he's going to stay there when a gang shows up to break in with this gate. It's hysterical. What we have to worry about are these sorts of communities. Because really what we're doing by forming these communities is we might as well put a sign, you know, right here that says, invade here first. Here's where the good stuff is. We can't close it out. We can't close out poverty. We can't close out hardship. It's going to be part of it. And we either figure that we're going to, as a group, figure out what to do about it, or we're going to suffer the consequences. And I'll tell you, some communities will, because they're not going to do anything about it. And there will be some communities who will basically say, no, I'm not letting my whole neighborhood go down. I'm going to make sure that people in my neighborhood are taken care of. We have rigid Cheneyism in the U.S., which basically says the American way of life is non-negotiable. Let me communicate and explain what that really means. What it means is defending our way of life means defending fuel. Because in order to be really secure, you have to be energy secure. So you have to have energy in order to increase American consumption. So therefore, war becomes a legitimate, justifiable thing. Because, you know, let's face it, your tar sands are under Canadian soil, but they're really ours. It's just an accident that nature happened to put them under there. So you have to give it to us, whether you want to keep it for yourself or not. Because we can't imagine living without fossil fuel, and we're not going to. You're sending it to China? No way. No way. So here's the scariest slide I'm showing tonight. This is a behavioral principle. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, which means that we all have a huge task in front of us, which is to begin to change those cognitive maps that we have, to begin to get over, and I think it takes about 2 years from the moment that you find out about peak oil and really let it sink in, and I encourage people not to make major life decisions in those first 2 years, because literally they think of running. I had one woman in rural England, and when I say rural, I'm saying she looked out her window and she saw medieval pasture. I mean, these pastures have been there since the Middle Ages. And she says, I got to run. I got to find a place in Wales. I'm like, listen, you live in the place people want to run to. You don't need to go anywhere. So we have these really odd reactions when we first learn about peak oil. And we have to let our world go from like this to all the way upside down and then rest for a while. We won't ever see the world in the same way again. But we have to at least adjust to the new reality. We think, because of fossil fuel, we can fly without a parachute. And there are so many around us that still believe that. But as we get in touch with what's going on with peak oil, we realize this is really where we are. And I personally believe that the culture that we're living in allows us to feel that we've got to be superheroes in our everyday life, that we have to live a life that is enormously stressful and is enormously demanding of us in our human form. And we're like frazzled people just trying to keep up this image. You know, we try to live this second life where the first life is just too crazy. So we go into the second life and we get to see rainforests because we're just destroying the ones that we actually have. And it's insane. It's completely insane. My title of my talk is wrong. It really shouldn't be, you know, keeping your sanity. It should be becoming sane. Because I think that that's essentially, when we look around, we're living an insane life. I'm not going to talk about solutions like needing to increase our freight trains. I've been getting around here by freight for the most part, and in the United States it's amazing to get on a freight train because it's like Disneyland. You know, you climb on and the conductor says, well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I'm saying, right? They act like it's a ride that's for fun, you know, because it's so rare that people are using it instead of driving. I'm not going to focus on that, although I will say that James Howard Kunstler says that Bulgaria would be ashamed of having a freight line, a train line like the United States has. And I won't spend too much time on food, but localizing food is an essential element of our future survival, because we will not be able to continue to use fossil fuels to grow food. And that's what we do now, is 10 calories of energy go into every single calorie of food, and that eventually is going to stop, which means we're going to need more land to grow food than we currently do. So here is truly my recommendation. Take a map, online, whatever, and get your house in focus, and then draw a circle around it, whether it's 5 miles or 10 miles, your choice, depends on how rural you are, right? And say to yourself, this area, everybody in this circle are my neighbors. We've lost the concept of neighbor. We believe that neighbor is just an accident of somebody who happens to live close to you. Because fossil fuel has allowed us to have designer friends and designer communities. And it leads us to believe that somebody who we talk to and never met on the internet that lives thousands of miles away is an intimate friend, even though you've never met them face to face. So we will do things because of fossil fuel, like we'll drive an hour to go to a boutique church that thinks with people who think just like we do and look like we do and act like we do and have the same political philosophies and all. That's not going to continue to happen without fossil fuel. You're going to have to start getting comfortable living around the people that you actually live around. Now, when I tell people this, it usually terrifies them, because one of the things that they will say is, I live around people who are extremely annoying. And that's one of the things that we're going to have to get used to. This is a book by John Curl, and I encourage you, if you haven't come across it, to look into it. It's called For All the People, and it talks about the history of communalism and the idea of and the many examples of people getting together, working cooperatively. Like one example he uses is during the last Great Depression, there was a marvelous example in Seattle, where basically they realized, a group of activists realized that the government wasn't going to come to their rescue. People were starving. People didn't have jobs. They didn't have clothing. They didn't have houses. So what they did is say, let's just create funny money, which they call scripts, and you who know how to make shoes, you make shoes. And the farmer who knows how to, you know, have run the orchard, you bring in fruit. And you make clothes, you know how to do that, and you build houses. And then they just exchange this stuff, this funny money, among themselves. And they started clothing and feeding people and putting them in houses, and everyone had jobs. A huge percentage of people. We can do that. We have not forgotten how to be that communal and cooperative. We might have forgotten how to make shoes, but that's not something that is something we can't learn how to deal with in our everyday life, of thinking about basics, getting back to basics. Another is, we need to start intensifying bonds between people. Now, I'm a couples therapist, that's what I do professionally, and a sex therapist. I work with people who have sexual issues and problems in a couple situation. And one of the research facts that really stunned me when I read it was that 40%, this was before the Great Depression that the U.S. is suffering from right now, 40% of the people who were married said they would consider divorce if their spouse lost their job. 40%! Well, I mean, it's stupid on so many levels, right? But one of the levels it's really stupid on is, if you know anything about millionaires, they tend to be men. They tend to be married to one woman for their entire life. And they've gone through at least 3 financial crashes before they earned their millions of dollars. So it's stupid on that level. But if you're suffering from an economic crash, what a stupid thing to say, okay, well, let's get divorced. Since, you know, everything's falling down, let me just try to make it on my own now. So intensifying bonds is a really important thing, and learning how to be intimate with people is something that we need to learn again, because so many of us have only, because of fossil fuel, maintained a certain type of relationship with other people. It's a relationship basically that says, I won't ask too much of you, and you don't ask too much of me, and we'll have fun, and we'll get along. The one thing I want to emphasize is that when you do to somebody else, help somebody else, the person who's getting the benefit is you. And this is true in study after study after study, that the people who you help are not really the main psychological beneficiaries of that help. You are. So one of the ways to really make people ill and die is put them in a nursing home and don't let them do anything for themselves. You just do everything, and you'll knock them off very fairly quickly. So what I mean that we need to begin to do is we need to begin to ask other people for help. We need to kick in the favor bank. We have to start a process by which we got to get comfortable asking, because that's the vulnerable position. Remember, that's the position that most of us don't want to be in, which is needing something. So to create that favor bank, more of us are going to have to hook up with other people and begin to ask of them, not just give to them. We also have to begin to have dinners together as a family, whether that family is biological or a community. And we used to, back in the 1970s, we used to have dinners together 5 nights a week. Today, of teenagers in families, 30% of them never eat a meal together week in and week out. That's outrageous as a species. You just don't do that. One of the things humans do is they bond through food. Overall, the average in the U.S. is 2 to 3 times a week we manage. And I don't know if it's true in Canada, but in the U.S., they schedule all after-school activities around dinner time. Do they do that here, too? The other thing we need to do is we need to get kids off of electronic entertainment devices. And I put that across the board. Whether it's TV, Game Boys, computers, their cell phones, whatever, study after study is beginning to show for both adults and for children that, especially for children, if they're spending more than 2 hours a day in front of an electronic entertainment device, they are suffering from mental illness. Increasingly, we're seeing symptoms of that. I work in a neighborhood that serves the poor, and it's gotten to the point where I have to tell my interns, before you go in there, tell the parent, they have to shut off all of those electronic devices a half hour before you show up, or you won't see them. You won't do play therapy with the kids. Because if you don't do that, what happens is it's like dealing with a drug addict and taking away the drug. The kids will beg and barter and promise, and they'll just go through withdrawal. And that really is what it seems like to me, that they become so addicted to the stimulus that they can't manage to pull themselves away from it. The Stanford study says it's true of adults too, that the average, and again, it varies from study to study, but you'll see it on a chart that the longer that adults spend in front of the computer, not checking email, but just basically spending time cruising the internet, the more depressive symptoms they get and the more socially isolated they become. So it becomes a circle, a loop, where they become socially isolated and depressed so they spend more time in front of the computer. And then they get even more, and then they spend more, and it becomes this negative loop. So we've got to start connecting with people and not through electronic entertainment devices. We've got to connect generations again. Right now, most elderly women live alone in our country. And that, as a species, is a bizarre turn of events. Didn't happen. Never happened before fossil fuel. We need to begin to teach children how to play. And I think most people would be appalled if they knew the number of children where we sit down to do play therapy with them, and first we have to teach them how to play, how to use their imagination, how to take nothing and create something out of it. This is something that the Great Depression kids knew. They knew how to go outside, take a rock, make a hopscotch on the ground, and play for hours. They knew how to take a bunch of string and make a ball out of it and get a baseball game going. These are things that are not going on today in any way in the same level. And part of the reason, especially in the U.S., but I believe it's happening in all urban areas, is that increasingly we're beginning to shrink the area that children can play in. It used to be that our grandparents or our great-grandparents, they left, they went out to the world, they could travel a long time, maybe miles from home, and they knew they had to be home at a certain time, but they could freely travel. Their children were restricted a lot more to the neighborhood, and now the grandchildren are often restricted to the yard, or sometimes they're never allowed to play without adult supervision. This is bizarre. Children normally play in groups together, multi-age groups, and learn how to negotiate. They learn how to get along and relate belly to belly to each other. And that's one of the things that we're not seeing in today's kids. They get very good at computers, but it's not going to be preparing them for a post-peak future. And here's a good one. We got to party more. We used to, in 1970, party an average of 14 to 15 times a year. We're a little over a month, once a month. Today, the average person parties 8 times a year. That's a 45% drop in partying. We got to start doing more of it. If you don't go to enough parties, you've got to start throwing them. If you need any assistance, Vandy is an excellent guide for how to throw a killer party. So she should start a one-on-one on how to do that. Gossip. Gossip has a wicked bad rap. But the truth is, people are gossips. And it helps us to communicate information about each other through the gossip line. And so, you know, there's a natural check and balance with gossip. You know, if somebody is just gossiping viciously without any purpose, they're usually socially isolated. So I'm not talking about vicious social gossip. I'm talking about the kind where, you know, you forget your mother's birthday and your sister calls you up and you go, "Kathy, you forgot Ma's birthday. You didn't give her a present." I'm like, "Oh, damn, I was waiting today." So I go get a present. I show up at her door and I say, "Mom, happy birthday. I didn't get a chance to come over yet, but happy." "Oh, honey," she says, "it doesn't matter. I didn't care." This is the benefit of gossip. It helps us. It connects us with each other. But gossip serves a sociobiological function as well, because it basically tells us those in the community, it sort of minimizes deadbeats, community deadbeats. And I think you know who those people are. You might be one of them. You show up for the potluck and you always are bringing either nothing or nothing anybody wants to eat. Now, if that's all you do, right, the gossip will go around. Don't invite them. Drag Ola. They never pitch in and they never help. But if you show up even empty-handed, but you're hysterically funny, or you start playing music, people will still want to have you around. So gossip can be for all different sorts of people, but it basically tells who's carrying their load, who's not, and how we can begin to relate to one another in ways that we can increasingly begin to trust. I mentioned annoying. How many people here know anybody who's annoying? Raise your hand if you do. I'm not saying you're annoying. I'm just saying other people are annoying. Yeah. And like I say, we've got loads and loads of words for annoying. And the reason we do is because it's so common. But the problem is not that people are annoying. The problem is with fossil fuel, we are starting to believe that they shouldn't be annoying, or we shouldn't be annoyed by them. So when they're wicked annoying, we think it's a problem instead of that it's life. How many people are active in transition towns here? So I think one of the things about transition towns is you get to learn how annoying people really are. Any group at all. But what I'm telling you is just because you're finding how annoying they are, that doesn't mean that you should quit. You need to get used to bizarre and odd bedfellows. You need to get used to the people who you normally wouldn't have anything in common with, because they're your neighbors. An example is a friend of mine, and he really is a friend of mine. He works on the museum with me, the historical museum with me. And he starts talking to me. He says, you know, Kathy, I don't believe in the global warming. And I like it's the global warming. You know, he adds the. So I don't believe in the global warming. I go, no, Steve, why not? He said, I am not lowering my electric bill. I don't care what they say. I am not lowering it. I said, well, what's your electric bill? He says, $12 a month. And I don't care what they say. I am not lowering it. This guy is so cheap. Wait a minute. We call it what? Sustainable, right? We have good names for it now. But, you know, in small town New England, we call it cheap. This guy is so cheap that he won't plug in an answering machine, so you can never get him because he doesn't want to use the electricity. And he goes out and he picks, you know, tonic. He picks herbs and stuff in the springtime and makes this tonic to drink. He's a wealth of information and knowledge, and he's a friend of mine, even though he doesn't believe in the global warming. He's one of the many odd bedfellows that I'm going to make. People who I disagree with on any number of things, but they're my neighbor. So I guess what I'm proposing to you is that we're all a bunch of bozos. What's another word for bozo in Canadian? I don't speak Canadian. Fathead, or what would you... What's that? Clown, joker, hoser. I don't know this word, hoser. Hoser. Anyway, I like fathead, but you know, a bozo, you know. We have to stop thinking of ourselves as superheroes. We have to start accepting that we're facing a huge problem, a problem we can't even conceive of, never mind devour a cognitive map around. And as a result of that, we have got to face the fact that we are all we have. As flawed, as annoying, as incompetent in so many ways, we're it. And if we're not going to take the lead to do something, nothing is going to get done. As I said to you, the politicians do not like to deal with the dilemmas. They just don't. So we're going to have to look at religious institutions, which before we may have completely abandoned, but they have a pattern set up for dealing with community and figuring out how to get into community. Some of them don't require any belief other than you're a bozo. And you don't have to believe in a higher power, you just have to believe you're not it. So churches and religious institutions are one way that you can think about going. Another is just to be able to relax. So few people now make relaxing part of their daily life. You know, I love this picture because what you're seeing here is, you know, a couple that they've opened up their heart to each other, and they're just so comfortable with each other that they can fall asleep on the outside and be in connection with everything that's around them. During the last Great Depression, we spent much more time outdoors than we do today. We had to. So this is my last slide of the evening. And I show you this slide because, as I said, we don't know for certain what the future is going to look like. And the reason we don't is because we haven't started writing in that book that we can make a future difference, or we can say it's none of our business and let it evolve however it's going to happen. Your active involvement or your active disengagement is going to impact what happens, but it is changing, and it's changing very, very quickly. It's not your grandchildren who are going to have to look at, deal with this. It's you, people in this room. So this is our challenge. Let's start writing in the book of the future to try to make it a little bit more humane for all of us. Thank you very much.
That was part of a two-part speech by Kathy McMahon, The Peak Shrink, recorded in Vancouver, Canada on October 18, 2010. Find part one of this important speech either at ecoshock.org on the Peak Oil page or at archive.org. Kathy's blog is peakoilblues.com. Thank you for listening.